It's John Hanson, and Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, is coming up next. How many camera-induced speed cameras have you gotten in the city of Chicago? Is it zero? Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? You're going to be shocked to find out how many the average household has gotten in the city of Chicago. I think you'll be shocked. And 2021 was a huge year. Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, a little later in the show, is going to stop by to chat about all things. Jonathan Merrill going to join by. He's the founder and managing principal of the law offices at Jonathan Merrill PC. And we're going to be talking about divorces here in the year 2022. And if they're back on track. And I guess that sounds a little callous. I guess I mean everything was clogged up because of the pandemic. And we're going to have the question of the day. We'll get to all that next on WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone line. We'll get to our question of the day in one moment. But I want to say hello to Iridian, our producer behind the glass. Iridian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
We're reunited again, Iridian.
We are. It feels great.
It feels good. You were gone for the holidays, some well-deserved time off, and you're back here to get legal. You excited?
I'm so excited. Let's start.
I agree. She's like, please let me turn off my mic. No, Iridian, later on in the show, later this hour, I think we'll get into it this hour, I, for the first time, saw a story and went, oh my gosh, this is a law story where I'm not the expert. Of course, never am. There's not an expert out there that's going to be good at this, but Iridian is going to be the expert. It's a law story about wrestling. And if you don't know Iridian Fierro, you don't know that she is one of the most eloquent wrestling fans out there. Iridian, you have a wrestling podcast too, right?
I do. I talk about wrestling pretty much every day.
You are a fanatic.
Yeah, I love it so much.
So I'm going to break down this crazy lawsuit story against WWE, and you're going to help us understand it, okay?
Yep, sounds good.
All right, 312-981-7200. Here's the deal with the question of the day today. I teased it at the end of the last show. I'm actually going to put a pause on the one that I gave you at the end of the last show. I'm going to start with a different one today. So if you know the answer to this, 312-981-7200, call in, take a stab in the dark, and you're going to win a prize if you get it right. And here it is. In 1934, there were 14,146 what in the United States? Today, there are 4,300. 1934, there were 14,146. Now, there are 4,300. 312-981-7200 if you think you know the answer. If you get that right, you're going to get a $50 gift card to the 50-50 Restaurant Group to be used at any one of their 14 fantastic establishments all over Chicago, including Roots Pizza and the 50-50 Sports Bar. I mentioned we're going to talk to Austin Berg. You can also just text in. I'm so curious. 312-981-7200. How many speeding tickets caused by a camera have you gotten in the city of Chicago? Or red light cameras. You can put them together. Just send me a quick note. And if it's you and your spouse, put that note of combined together. Because I am shocked that if you average it out over the entire city of Chicago, what the average number of tickets the family households got in 2021 in terms of tickets. That I'm just curious about. So 312-981-7200, I'll take your answers on that. But again, our question of the day, in 1934, there were 14,146 what? And now there are only 4,300. And again, you're going to get a big prize. The call number for that is 312-981-7200. We'll try to get a couple of those answers here in just a moment. Before we take the break, I also want to tell everyone to make sure you listen till the 7 o'clock hour. As always, listen all the time, of course. But we have Ray Kaplan coming on at around 6:30, and you know her as the student loan expert. And there is something happening that is going to expire in the end of October, and that seems like a long time. But this is something that she says she's already helped someone save $170,000 of loan forgiveness that they didn't even know that they were eligible for. And Ray Kaplan's going to come by and chat exactly who we're talking about, who is eligible for this. It may not save you $170,000, but you might be entitled to a lot in terms of savings. So Ray Kaplan's going to join us as well. Again, Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. We'll talk about all things speed cameras, et cetera, et cetera. And Jonathan Merrill's going to join us in just a little bit as well to talk about all things divorce here in 2022. Before we go to break, let's at least get one guess here on the question of the day. Brian, how are you doing here today?
I am doing good. I'm doing good. How about yourself? Happy New Year.
Very good. Thank you very much. Where are you calling from, Ryan?
Naperville.
Okay. In the United States, Brian, there were 14,146 blank in 1934. Today, there are only 4,300. What's your guess, Brian?
I'm thinking payphones.
That's a really good one. I'd actually be shocked if there were still 4,300 payphones. Maybe 4,300 operating ones. I don't know. It's a great guess, Brian. It's not what I'm looking for, though. Thanks for calling, okay?
Take care. Have a good week.
Yeah, you too. Hey, John, you're on WGN. John, where are you calling from?
St. Charles.
St. Charles. Love the western suburbs. Yes. What's your guess for what there were 14,000 of back in the day, now only 4,300?
How about water towers?
Ooh, that's an interesting guess. Are there less water towers generally than there used to be?
I don't know. Probably.
You know, I guess
there's better systems now.
Right, you're right. And they're bigger now. They're better. They probably used to be, you know, the smaller variety, served less people. That's not the answer I'm looking for. I am now curious to see if there's less water towers than there used to be. John, have a great night, my friend, okay?
Right on. You too.
312-981-7200 if you've got a guess. We'll get some of that in Jonathan Merrill after this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Hey, everyone, I'm John Hanson. Thanks so much for listening. We're taking you up to Blackhawks pregame with Joe Brand at the top of the hour, at which point I will be hustling my bum over to the United Center, where I'll also be hosting the game there on the big screen against the Ducks. And as you heard David Hochberg mention, I'm going to be out on the ice with him. As always, I do shoot the puck, but David Hochberg's our sponsor tonight for Shoot the Puck, and he's giving away rent or a mortgage for a year as people get a chance to get that puck into the little hole at the net. So that will be awesome. That'll be in the first intermission. So if you're on your way to the game, be sure to stay in your seat for that. We'll be sure to have a lot of fun. 312-981-7200. Jonathan Merrill in one moment. Just cleaning up one thing. I was asking for people how many tickets you've gotten in your household from the cameras, for the speed cameras we're going to talk about in the next hour. 773 says, I'm 67 years old, and in my life, I've lived in Chicago always, traveled more than 15 miles to work daily, and I've never received a moving violation, a red light ticket, a right turn ticket. I don't break the laws. Well, that is awesome, 773. I'll tell you why I'm talking about this today is because I, for the first time ever, got something in the mail, and I didn't get a ticket. I got a warning for going 26 miles an hour on Ogden Avenue, which for the great vast expanse of Ogden Avenue is totally legal. But for some reason, 26 miles an hour on Ogden Avenue during one little stretch is not okay at 10:50 at night. And it's under the guise of the safety of children. And there was not a child to be seen on Ogden Avenue at 10:55 at night when I was driving. A lot of other people are more peeved. We'll talk about that. 312-981-7200. We've also been doing the question of the day. In 1934, there were 14,000 of these in the United States. Now there's only 4,300. Really quickly, let's get a guess from Dawn. Dawn, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm on the way to the Hawks game.
Hey, you're going to come say hi to me up in section 312?
I wish I can, yes.
Yeah, come give me a fist bump. We'll say hello and be sure to watch what happens in the first intermission. All right, Dawn, what's your guess?
I think there were 4,300 now drive-in theaters.
I don't think there's that many, Dawn, right? It's a great guess, right? Because there were certainly a ton back in the day. I also don't know if there were 14,000 in 1934, right? It wasn't quite as popular until the 50s. So it's a great guess, just not quite what we're looking for, though, Dawn, okay?
All right. Thank you. I'll see you at the game.
Yeah, hopefully. Go Hawks. Yeah, for sure, for sure. All right. Keep those guesses coming. I see Joanne. I saw Jim, I think, called in, too. We'll try and get some more guesses a little bit later on. But let's chat with Jonathan Merrill. I love chatting with any other Jonathan I can. I don't rarely get to do so. Jonathan Merrill, how are you doing here this evening?
I'm good, John. Jonathan, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I go by John, and there's a bunch of other Johns at the station here, J-O-H, and I'm thinking about switching and just going back to Jonathan, because it certainly is a great name, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been Jonathan. My parents they don't like when people call me John, so I always say, well, why'd you name me Jonathan? But, yeah, usually Jonathan, but I get John plenty
as
well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, whatever. It's a great name. We'll take it. Jonathan Merrill, you do a lot of great things with family law. We're here to talk a little bit about divorce today. And I guess my first question out of the bat is, for the last year, we've been just hearing how backed up things are in the court system. There's been a lot of adjustments over the past 2 years, right? Especially in family law. Are things back to, I don't want to say normal in person, but is there such a backlog now or no?
Well, it's kind of the new normal now. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot of court closure. Most people are not going back to court for their cases. very limited circumstances. But when COVID hit and courts closed, it was kind of mayhem, and no one really knew what was going on, whether, you know, there was going to be Zoom or when there was Zoom. How did you get onto the court appearance? When is the court appearance? You know, they've really ironed it out over the past 2 years, obviously, because that's really all there has been is Zoom. Some of the collar counties like Will County, DuPage, they've opened up a little more. But for the most part, Cook County and the Daly Center is really, for the most part, all Zoom. So they've had to adapt. Lawyers have had to adapt. And like I said, the new normal is just, you know, getting into court in front of your computer.
So if someone wants to, if they maybe want to go forward and they've already kind of made the decision to divorce, or if there's a post-decree thing or anything along the lines of family law, is there any excuse to wait, or can people at least kind of start that process? There should be no fear of, oh, this is never going to happen, it's going to take forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not completely smooth, but for the most part, cases are starting to move again. So I would say there's no reason to really delay doing something that you want to do or need to do, because the court system's just functioning, you know, through Zoom now. That's, like I said, that's how things go now. And the court system, the clerk's office, lawyers, judges, they've all adapted. So, you know, it's crazy. It's been 2 years now. So we've had 2 years of this new system already. So it's moving pretty smooth.
That's great. I'm glad it is moving smooth. I mean, if there's one thing we need to keep up with it, it's the court system, and no matter what kind of law we're talking about. So, you know, there's been so many rumors. You know, we heard at the start of the pandemic, oh, kind of even jokingly at first, right, that first couple of weeks, this is going to lead to so many divorces because everyone has to stay at home. It's so stressful. Well, when a couple of weeks dragged on to a couple of months and now years, I feel like that has really kind of sunk in as reality. It's really upended a lot of family situations that maybe weren't so great to begin with. So was the hype of, oh, this is really going to lead to an explosion in divorces, has that come true, a little bump? What have you seen?
I mean, yes, it's definitely increased the rate of divorce. I mean, especially at the outset in that first 6 months to a year, you know, with everyone kind of living in the pressure cooker of everyone under the same roof, no one's really doing anything outside their home. You see an uptick in, obviously, turmoil within inside the home. Unfortunately, like domestic violence incidents increased as well. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely caused a bump in the divorce rate. I think things have kind of leveled out a little now because, again, I keep saying the same term. It's like this new normal where people are working from home. But for the most part, we had that bump at the beginning, and I think it's, you know, it's gotten a little more back to normal now in the past 6 months to a year, but definitely still busy because, you know, it's not just the divorce rate that bumps, but it's all the people who were already divorced, or, you know, they were impacted by changes in people's employment, or, like I said, domestic violence, you know, differing views on e-learning and vaccination. So there's just all these issues that never existed before, really, which were brought to the forefront once COVID came.
We're getting a lot of great text message questions. You can keep them coming in, 312-981-7200. And you just kind of touched on one from the 708. How has COVID affected the parenting issues in terms of people's beliefs about mask wearing, going to school, not going to school, traveling? I mean, that just puts an added stress, especially if two parents don't see eye to eye on that thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, these issues are coming up, you know, especially with, you know, vaccines and boosters and e-learning, mask wearing, you know, the Omicron. I mean, you know, it's one thing after another, obviously, with the pandemic. And then, you know, you get parents who are divorced or getting divorced and have differing views on, you know, getting the kids to school. What should they be doing? Should they be doing certain activities, or should they stop doing activities? You know, should they wear a mask, go to school, all the things you kind of touched on. These are all coming to the forefront. And if people can't resolve them on their own or through mediation, they're going to wind up in front of a judge. And, you know, judges don't want to make these kind of judgment calls. They're not there to parent these children, but, you know, they're getting these issues put in front of them all the time now.
Yeah, Jonathan, I never thought about that. And if you don't want to answer this question specifically, that's fine, because I know probably each case is different. But yeah, what if a split parents, the dad wants the kid vaccinated, the mom doesn't? How does that get decided? Could that eventually end up in front of a judge? I can't imagine a judge making that decision.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, if as a last resort, you know, the issue could come before a judge, and judges are put in, you know, the uncomfortable position because obviously, you know, there's so much political, you know, nonsense behind all the vaccines and not vaccinated, vaccinated. So, yeah, judges are, you know, they're very reluctant, obviously, to have to make these calls. And, you know, you get, obviously, if you go to any sort of like contested hearing, could get to the, you know, craziness of bringing in a doctor to testify. But obviously, you know, the issue of should a kid get vaccinated or not, we know how divided the country is about that. And, you know, judges certainly don't want to be put in a spot where they have to make that call. But unfortunately, it's happening.
Yeah, parents, don't let a judge make that call. Come to an agreement between the two of you somehow, some way. I think that's best for everybody.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's the right
figure
answer.
Figure it out. You mentioned employment. We only got about a minute before the news, but just you could at least start this answer. 630 wanted to know, I lost my job. You know, making payments has been real difficult. Can that person get some help with that to say, hey, look, my situation has changed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the issues of support, whether it be spousal support, child support, any issues related to support, they're always modifiable. If there's a change in circumstances, you know, whether it's losing your job or reduction in your income, or on the other side, an increase in someone's income, you know, either parent may, you know, petition the court for a modification of support.
It's important stuff. I mean, obviously, we want everyone up on their payments and to pay what they need to pay and, you know, the people that are owed get paid. But obviously, things change along the lines. Tell you what, Jonathan, I'm going to put you on hold. We're going to take a break for the news and continue our conversation after that. If you're heading into the Hawks game right now or leaving your car, MerrillFamilyLaw.com, M-E-R-E-L, FamilyLaw.com. And Jonathan, the number I have here, 312-487-2795. That's where people can call for a consultation, right?
Yes, there's actually an easier domain to use is ChicagoDivorce.com.
Even easier.
You know, Merrill Family Law. But ChicagoDivorce.com, and that'll get you to my website.
I'm sure that's in my notes somewhere, and I looked right over that. ChicagoDivorce.com. Come on, John Hanson. More with Jonathan Merrill after this. Time for the news on WGN. So that's in the next hour. But we're talking with Jonathan Merrill now about all things divorce. You go to ChicagoDivorce.com, and you're right, Jonathan, that led right to your page. Very seamlessly, the law offices of Jonathan Merrill. Thanks for that's a real easy domain name for people to get.
It is an easy one. Much easier than spelling my name and remembering that.
Well, right, exactly. Now, is it two R's, two L's for the record?
Right.
It is one of each. We're talking about, you know, divorces and people having, you know, maybe been thinking about it for a while. Maybe the pandemic has heightened a lot of those things. What's your advice for someone who is considering a divorce at this time? Like, when is the time to talk to a lawyer? Is it after you've made your decision, or is it when you've, you know, started going down that road emotionally?
Well, I think it's different for everyone. I think everyone gets to a point when their marriage isn't, you know, going great, where they realize it's at the point, and, you know, whether they have children or not, they just are at the point where they think it's time to talk to a lawyer. Usually, by the time someone's talking to me, things aren't great in the marriage, and, you know, whether it's the divorce is really imminent or, you know, they believe it's coming sooner than later, you know, people are contacting me just to understand, you know, their rights and responsibilities when it comes to children, custody, support, the division of assets. So, I mean, it can never hurt to contact a lawyer just to kind of, you know, even if it's having a 10, 15 minute initial phone call to get information and just knowledge that most people don't have going into the process. So it can't hurt to ever call a lawyer and find out, you know, what's going on.
But if someone's expecting to call to get a counseling session or to get pushed over the ledge, like, that's not your role, right? Like, that puts you in a real weird position.
Yeah, I mean, divorce lawyers definitely wear, you know, the lawyer hat, and we also wear the therapist hat.
Yeah.
So that comes with the territory. I mean, we're obviously, you know, taking clients through a very difficult process, which is obviously emotional, and you know, we're there obviously to guide them through the legal process, but also be there for them, you know, emotionally, because it's not an easy thing to go through.
Is that why you do it? Not because it's, yeah, obviously it's a very difficult thing, but at the end of the day, what you've done is you've navigated and helped someone get through what could be a very difficult thing and see them on to a start of a brand new chapter of their life. Is that one of the reasons why you do what you do?
I mean, that's definitely a fulfilling part of it. You know, people think divorce and they think, you know, it's this horrible thing. And obviously, you know, it's not an easy thing to go through and can be very difficult. But what people lose sight of is the fact that, you know, this is the beginning of the next stage of someone's life. And it's obviously, you know, moving on to a new period for people who have, you know, been trapped in a relationship that, you know, wasn't making them happy, or, you know, even an abusive relationship. This really kind of, you know, gives them a sense of freedom and a weight off their shoulders once they get through the process. But obviously not an easy thing to go through, but many people think it's very rewarding once it's over.
So I have like anecdotal evidence of this. So please correct me if my anecdotes are way off, which wouldn't be the first time. So obviously the stigma of divorce has come a long way since the last century, like 100 years ago, right, where it was almost unheard of. And of course, now it's a lot different. And in fact, it's a much more, I don't want to say open conversation between people, and this isn't across the board. So correct me if I'm wrong, but even are things at least getting a little bit more, people are a little more clear-headed about the process going into it, because there isn't the stigma of, oh, I shouldn't do it. And maybe there's a little bit more amicable divorces now than you used to see 10, 15, 20 years ago, or am I crazy?
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, you definitely, you know, people, there's definitely been a shift lately to try to avoid litigation.
Right.
And, you know, seeking alternate dispute resolution through mediation or a process called collaborative divorce, and really just trying to resolve things without, you know, the courtroom setting and putting the decision in the hands of a judge. People are trying to shift away from that, but, you know, you still have your high intensity, high conflict, you know, World War III kind of divorce cases that exist. And, you know, there's a million reasons why those
right.
happen. It could be the people, the issues, even the lawyers, you know, out there that are kind of forcing litigation, which is certainly not how I practice, but
well,
there are those out there.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, because litigation obviously is a lot more involved, and that would get you more involved. But if someone comes to you and says, I want to do mediation, you can still be there for them and help them through that process, because that's what they want.
Yeah, absolutely. And as, you know, as there is this trend shifting toward, you know, favoring mediation and resolving things out of court, there's also been a trend to what's called attorney-assisted mediation. So you're going through the mediation process with a neutral, but you're also, you know, each party is going to have an attorney going through it with them, advising them along the way.
Yeah, and that certainly helps out. I mean, like, this isn't something that you don't want to be bringing a piece of paper together and you just iron out, you know, the differences between two people. I mean, no one ever wants to hear the sentence, get the lawyers involved, but like, certainly they can, like, you guys can make things easier, right? You can just see the blind spots, because I think a lot of people go into the thing that they know exactly what they want and, oh, my spouse wants this, we're going to be just fine. But there's a lot of things that people don't think about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not all lawyers are bad. I know that's what many people think, but there are actually lawyers out there.
Not on this show, Jonathan. Everyone,
okay, good.
We love our lawyers, okay?
Okay, good, good. But yeah, lawyers are there, obviously, to educate people as they're going through the process, to give them what their options are, to explain, you know, if you take this path, this is what you can expect. If you could take that path, this is what to expect. And then to also juxtapose what's going on in mediation and the outcome versus what, you know, a court's likely to do in the event you litigate. So, you know, lawyers are always explaining to clients what their options are, weighing the pros and cons of each decision, and, you know, giving them insight that they wouldn't ordinarily have if they were navigating this by themselves.
Chatting with Jonathan Merrill, and we're talking, by the way, ChicagoDivorce.com is where you go for the website for more information. Jonathan, besides talking to you, what do you recommend people do before they talk to you? Not only make decisions, but like, order immediately afterwards. Is there some paperwork people should start to be getting in order? Should someone know exactly where their money is in their situation, what the joint checking account passwords are? Like, are there things that people should do to arm themselves to make sure that they are going to be A-OK financially as they even begin the divorce proceedings?
Yeah, I mean, these are obviously questions that people ask me once we talk, and, you know, what should I be doing? What should I be thinking about? But obviously the answers are, you know, getting a grasp on your finances, understanding, you know, what the people have, you know, perhaps inventorying finances. And, you know, this is a more difficult task for, you know, perhaps the spouse that isn't, you know, controlling all the money or necessarily privy to the daily, you know, finances of the couple. But it's always important to get a grasp on finances. Other than that, you know, the lawyers are there to kind of steer the clients as to what to do. And the process itself obviously involves the exchange of financial information and discussion about, you know, any documentation that might be needed throughout the case.
I know this will be a specific case-by-case basis, but I don't know if you can give us a broad range. 618 wants to know, how long, if I start a divorce proceeding now, is it going to take till we're all done? I mean, I guess ballpark it just, I mean, let's say it's a pretty open and shut case. There's not too many dramas about it. How long does that typically take?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question that every single person asks when they come in to see me, and it's really a question that I answer without a specific answer.
Okay.
It's really hard to say. I mean, you could have divorces that take 2 months. You could have divorces that take 3.5 years or more.
Okay.
So it's such a huge spectrum. But, you know, the average divorce, if there's not too many complications and not too much of a contested issue, you're probably looking around 6 months to a year at the most, I would say. Somewhere in that 6 to 9 months is for like a very somewhat smooth divorce. And obviously there are extremes that, you know, both sides of the spectrum. If things get done quickly, and obviously if cases drag on with high conflict, they can go on for a really long time.
312 wants to know, each of us we're going through a divorce. Each of us own businesses. Valuations are all over the place right now. Even things like that, right? Like the assets you have in your business with the changing climate with COVID-19, that really throws a wrench in things too, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, whenever you have, you know, cases where a party or both parties own a business and you have to get a valuation of the business, oftentimes, you know, one spouse will get their own evaluation, the other will get the other, and there's usually a huge delta between what the values are. So those cases are more difficult to settle. And often take a lot longer than your, you know, average divorce, because the asset, the business, and the value thereof is often, you know, the most valuable asset in the estate. So, you know, finding and determining a value can obviously often take, you know, the court weighing in as to what the value is.
I imagine your law offices have handled stuff like that, though. You're okay. You got it.
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time.
All right. Merrill Family Law is... No, I was about to give the wrong website again, Jonathan. Well, you can go to MerrillFamilyLaw.com. It'll work.
Yeah, that works, too. You'll get to the same place.
I'm just giving everyone everything. I want people to have as many tools in their toolbox to reach you as they can, Jonathan.
Chicago, I appreciate it.
ChicagoDivorce.com. Is there a phone number you got? Is that 312-487-2795 a good place for people to go or no?
Yeah, that works, and we also 312-408-7000 is another.
Oh,
so either one. ChicagoDivorce.com is the easiest to remember.
Google it, people. That's what I tell people nowadays. Come on, you know what to do.
Right.
Jonathan Merrill, I really enjoy this conversation. I'm looking forward to another one because we've got a lot of questions. I think people, and they love texting in divorce questions. This happens every time we have a divorce lawyer on. I think people are afraid to call in, which totally makes sense, right? You want to keep your cards close to the vest. So I like that. Text your questions in. And Jonathan, next time you come on, we'll get some more on for you, okay?
Great. Thank you, John.
ChicagoDivorce.com. Jonathan Merrill, take care.
Take care. You too.
All Bye-bye. Right. He's a good thought leader on this sort of subject, someone who knows the ins and outs of that. We'll get to more of that a little bit later on, maybe another episode coming up. Hope to have Jonathan back. All right, 312-981-7200. Two things we're going to do after the break. We're going to hopefully get an answer to the question of the day, which is in the year 1934, there were 14,146 blank. Now there are 4,300 blank. 312-981-7200. If you get the answer, you're going to get a $50 gift card to the 50-50 Restaurant Group to be used at any one of their 14 fantastic establishments in Chicago. And we're going to find out why wrestling is making legal news with our own Iridian. After this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We are 1 hour and 7 minutes away from Blackhawks pregame with Joe Brand. And that's when I start hustling over to the United Center to get there in time for puck drop. 7:30 against the Ducks. It's going to be a big game. Hawks going for four in a row. And David Hochberg's going to try and give away rent and mortgage for a year. Four contestants on the ice in the first intermission. I'll be down there, and hopefully we can get a contestant to win that. Hopefully a few of them. We can put Hochberg out of business. That'd be great. All four win. Now, Hochberg is rooting for that, I'm sure. Let's go to James on WGN. James, how are you doing here this evening?
How are you? I'm calling for the question of the day.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me repeat it just to get it on up for folks. Here it is again. In 1934, there were 14,146 blank in the U.S. Today, there are 4,300. James, what's your guess?
I'm going to guess commercial banks. Is, you know, they had the what was going on then with the Depression and all that. And after the Depression, they all went out of business. That's my guess. Commercial banks.
You know, James, you are good at context clues, and you are absolutely correct. Congratulations.
All right.
You are going to win our prize. It's a $50 gift card to the 50-50 Restaurant Group to be used at any one of their 14 fantastic establishments over Chicago, including Roots Pizza and the 50-50 Sports Bar. You know what's interesting, though, James, is that I don't have the number for right before the market crash, like a 28. I only have from 34 on when the government started keeping track, when they started regulating the banks more. So it wasn't a very steep drop-off. It's actually been pretty steady since then.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, because I think after the crash, it was people think that it was more of a gradual.
Yeah,
the books
exactly.
I've read, you know, as opposed to just like overnight.
Right, and FDR shut down the banks in 33 a few days into his administration, pumped the money back in, made sure that they were regulated by the FDIC, and here we are. Okay, I know way too much about this, James. Thanks for your time, okay?
Thanks for all the info. Thanks so much.
Yeah, stay on the line. Iridian's going to help you on out. I know way too much about banks. But Iridian, put him on hold, but don't chat with him quite yet and get his info, because I have to chat with you. Okay. You ready to chat about the story?
Ready. Let's do it.
Okay. So this is a legal story and it's a wrestling story. And thank gosh we have the expert at both those things across the glass. We only got a minute or so. But WWE is suing a rival, MLW
yes.
Media. What is MLW?
Yeah, MLW is Major League Wrestling, and they are based in New York, and it was founded by someone who actually worked with WWE before.
Okay, so they do wrestling events similar to what you see at WWE?
Yeah, it's a wrestling promotion.
Do they have a different shtick than WWE?
Not really, it's just a smaller company.
Because AEW is also another one.
Yes, AEW is also huge. It's like the number two wrestling promotion right now.
And while some people might think on the surface they look the same, there are differences.
Yes.
Between AEW. AEW is very inclusive.
Yes.
Supporting. I went to an AEW show and loved it years ago.
I didn't know this about
the first one at like the Allstate, used to be. Now I think it's the
Yes.
Yes. Whatever the name of the stadium
now
is.
Arena.
Yeah, Now Arena. So MLW seems to be suing, saying that WWE has a monopoly on some of the venues and the rights. Is that what the gist of it is?
Yeah, that's what the gist is they're saying that WWE is preventing them from actually expanding and growing and getting TV deals, like with Tubi and Vice TV. So that's going to be a really interesting story to follow along with, because I think that it's, you know, got a little weight to it.
You think it's got some legs?
Yeah.
I don't know, though, because AEW has carved out a niche, right?
Yes.
And they're doing well. So if I were WWE, I would say, well, hold on, we've got a competitor in the market, too.
Yeah.
And we aren't. And certainly WWE, AEW, they're not friends, right?
Yeah. Oh, no.
They're stealing from each other. Not stealing, but you know what I mean? Taking performers
hoarding talent, hiring people so they won't go to the rival company. It's like, could you imagine if the Chicago Bears just picked everyone?
No. I can't imagine if they picked anyone.
There would be no league.
Iridian, I couldn't imagine if they picked a single person correctly, let alone everyone. All right, thanks, Iridian, for breaking that down. All right, we're going to talk speeding tickets. And we're also going to talk to Ray Kaplan. That's all coming up in the next hour of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. 720 WGN, a good Saturday evening to you, everybody. One more hour here of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, taking you up to Blackhawks pregame hockey at the top of the hour at 7 o'clock. Okay. Speaking of Blackhawks hockey, a couple weeks ago, I was driving home from the game. Y'all know I work over there. And I thought I was going at a pretty normal speed down Ogden. And all of a sudden, bang, a flash of light behind me. And of course, I knew it was the telltale sign of a speed camera having gotten me, which I thought was strange. It was in the evening. I wasn't going all that fast. I didn't even know if there was a park or a school nearby, but certainly at 10:15 in the evening, there weren't any kids darting out into the street. And sure enough, a couple days later in the mail, I got my warning, my first warning. I'm probably one of the few Chicagoans who still is on the warning level as these speed cameras continue to get everybody. And Austin Berg joins us now from the Illinois Policy Institute. And first of all, Austin, thanks for hopping on with us here today.
Yeah, great to be here.
That's a pretty common story, I bet you hear from people of, I wasn't really going all that fast, and it's because of a newish rule that Mayor Lightfoot instituted that a lot of people are getting surprised by getting letters in the mail.
Oh, yeah. If it's any consolation, you're not alone. Yeah. So last year, we found over 2.3 million speed camera tickets issued in the city of Chicago.
2.3 million
tickets.
Does that include the warnings or no?
That does not include the warnings. And the warnings were for this sort of initial period, I believe in the spring for a couple of months where folks were getting warnings and then they sort of flipped the switch. Overnight, and that switch you're talking about is that 6 mile per hour threshold, getting a ticket for going just 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. Before that change, these cameras were issuing 1,100 tickets per day. That's a lot of tickets per day.
Right.
But after that change, it spiked to 9,500 tickets per day. So it was an 8 or 9X increase overnight in the number of tickets. And now for the year, that's more than 2 tickets for every single household in the city of Chicago. So it's really just exploded to kind of preposterous levels.
Yeah, you mentioned 2.3 million tickets. I'm doing some quick math. You did some for us, too. Well, we got about 2.7, 2.8. Man, we're going to be down to 2.3 million residents if this keeps up. People are, I mean, it's crazy.
I think that's, so obviously the first response when people are presented with data like this is, well, aren't these making our streets safer? And yeah, of course, there are some safety effects of speed cameras, no doubt about it. People can change their behavior a bit around these cameras. We have data that shows that. But there's a cost to doing that. And similarly, you could say, well, why don't we just have a speed camera on every single intersection, and it tickets people going 1 mile an hour over the speed limit? Like, there's no limiting principle. And right now you're having, like, so for instance, we're talking to Alderman Jeanette Taylor. Not a fiscal conservative alderman by any means. She's right. She's a Democratic Socialist alderman, very outspoken. And she says, you know, in my community, I'm getting calls about people getting these cameras every single day and people getting shot every single day. I'm not hearing about traffic accidents in my neighborhood every single day. People are really, really angry about these tickets. And that is a cost. The cost is people feel like they're being, it's called taxation by citation, that they do not trust law enforcement to actually be doing things that matter to their community. They're just out to get them and find them on this sort of ticky-tack stuff.
Could you make the argument that Illinois, you know, where obviously police are limited in what they're able to do right now, that by allowing this automated ticket system happening, that it can allow them to focus on more important issues? Have you heard that argument?
Absolutely. But by the same token, it can make law enforcement's job harder because people are just less trust. Like, we've talked about this a lot on the Mincing Rascals mm-hmm. podcast, but the trust between the city and the police is broken, and the trust between communities and police is broken in a really bad way. A way to erode that trust even further is slapping people with these endless fees and fines from these nameless, faceless cameras throughout the city. People just feel like they're getting the raw end of a deal. This is $73 million from January to October last year, just in fine revenue. And that's money that now the city is relying on. So it's becoming harder to roll it back. But again, there's aldermen here from their constituents every day about this issue. And I really think there is a groundswell of support for at least changing the 6 mile an hour threshold and, let alone that, taking down the cameras entirely.
Yeah.
Like, they're just, the people hate them so much.
I want to get into the disparity of the neighborhoods in a moment, but I do just want to put an emphasis on this. Is if you don't live in the city, I know our listeners are all over the place, or don't drive through the city all that much, but everyone can relate to this, right? I think everyone has in mind, you know, most people want to drive safely, right? Like, I think, despite what we see on the roadways, I think for the most part, people want to be law-abiding citizens. And I always have in my mind that, like, 10 or 9 mile an hour thing where I'm like, all right, no matter what, even on the expressway, that's going to kind of be my limit above the limit in which we all go. And I think that for the most part, everyone abides by it. There is a huge difference between going 6 over and 10 over, and it's very unconscious. Like I, that's what I, like when I got flashed with that camera, I was kind of surprised and I looked down and I was like, huh, I guess I was six or seven over. It's, it really, there is a difference between six and 10. I don't care which way you swing it.
There's a huge difference. And so this is the other thing with regard to traffic safety. If you think of some of the really broad, you know, through streets in Chicago that almost seem like highways, like they're designed to go a certain speed, even if that's a little bit over the limit, that's sort of the way to reduce speeds, if that's your goal, is to redesign how those streets look and work and feel to drivers. That's the most robust, safest way to do it. Every expert agrees on that.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is sort of like, so you can put like sidewalks that are closer into the streets. You can put lanes for bikes that go counter to the flow of traffic. Mm. You can make intersections instead of having, you think of an intersection like, I don't know, Lincoln and Belmont, right? Like 7 million different different lanes going every which direction. Making those lanes closer to the curb cutouts, closer to the center of the intersection. So there's not as much of that wide open kind of abyss space. Redesigning those spaces can help reduce crashes in a way that is much less slimy mm-hmm. than these speed cameras and doesn't just erode people's trust in their government.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. Maybe if the city was saying, and this is not what they're saying, okay, we're going to generate some revenue to reduce speeding while at the same time all the money from this revenue was going in towards those sort of infrastructure
exactly.
changes you mentioned,
right.
then you could say, okay, I could see where this is a connection. We're trying to tackle this on both ends, the revenue side, the behavior side, and then on the end of the day, we're going to change things fundamentally. But that's not it. This just goes to the city's coffers in general, right?
Yeah, exactly. It just goes into the general fund and it can be spent on anything. And especially like with that plan, you can say, okay, once we've generated this much, then they're gone, right? It just becomes very clear. Like we've made all the improvements. We're good to go.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. All right. We'll have more with Austin Berg. We're going to talk about how disproportionately these cameras affect different neighborhoods. After this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, taking you up to Blackhawks hockey at 7 o'clock. Okay, continuing our conversation with Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, talking about the red light cameras and the huge, and not the red light, but also the speed cameras, and the huge increase in the number of camera tickets that have been issued in 2021 once they lowered the threshold to driving over 6 miles an hour, get you a ticket instead of 10. And Austin, I know by your publishing and the great stories you guys do there, it really affects different neighborhoods in different ways.
It's really disproportionately hurting Black and Brown communities in Chicago. And that's for a variety of reasons. But one of them is that this, just what I was talking about, the streets oftentimes in those neighborhoods are designed almost to encourage speeding. And so the people driving on those streets are the folks living in those communities, typically Black and Latino Chicagoans. So you see the cameras generating more than $1 million. In fact, we talked about Alderman Jeanette Taylor. Mm-hmm. She had one camera at one intersection in her ward that generated $3 million by itself.
In just 2021.
In just 1 year. And if you think about that, I think the tickets are like $100. That's like 30,000 tickets from one camera. It's almost every blink of an eye. Like
yeah.
during this interview, probably 20 tickets generated from that one camera.
Yeah.
Like, no one thinks that that's a robot. And here's the other thing. If they really worked, that number would be dropping precipitously because everybody would know that that camera is there. So we really got to slow down. That's not what's happening. Because that's not what the street is designed to encourage.
It's interesting, though. I will say, so I have one right by my house, right by Lane Tech High School, and I travel that every single day. And I do notice that some people kind of have learned it. Now, maybe that's because, and it's on Western, which is a major thoroughfare, because you do see people all the time not notice and the lights go off. But, you know, I slow down to, it's a 20 mile an hour zone because it's a school zone. So you feel like you are crawling. But what's amazing is everyone crawls for those, I don't know, 500 feet. And then everyone zooms ahead to
right.
go as fast as they can to try and beat the light at Belmont. And then I've seen people then zoom through the Belmont intersection because they've accelerated. And now they don't quite know exactly. They can't brake in time. And our sense of our pace is all off. So I often wonder, I'm like, are we just, you know, risky, you know, okay,
shifting,
great.
Shifting the crashes to different intersections, 100%. And right. This is sort of the oftentimes the biggest folly, I think, of city planners who put in this sort of stuff. And obviously, you know, it's a combination of there are experts who say, oh, yeah, this is a really good tool. It could be a really good idea. All the city and all the elected leaders see is, oh, this is going to generate money that we don't have to hike elsewhere in the budget. And people will kind of go along with it because technically they're breaking the law. They're going over the speed limit. So it's this kind of these two incentives align in a way that's really bad for the rest of us. But what they really are poor about in this planning is the unintended consequences of what they're doing. And that is one of them, right? Maybe it changes driving behavior at different intersections. And we saw this, in fact, with red light cameras. If you remember, the data on red light cameras in Chicago, which are a grift of their own, mm-hmm. different than speed cameras, is that, yeah, T-bone crashes were reduced by a bit. But you know what spiked a lot? People getting rear-ended at intersections because they were so afraid of going through at the last second yellow, yeah. And it caused more of those crashes. And that's just something that often those unintended consequences, like elected officials are just kind of blinded, like in a cartoonish way, by these dollar signs in their eyes, and they forget about, oh, there might be other consequences when we put in a tool like this.
You mentioned the red light cameras. This was interesting. I've told this story on air before, but I came home from a trip at the airport. I had driven to the airport and parked there. I came home to the O'Hare parking lot to a boot on my car. And I was like, okay. Turns out I had 3 red light tickets that I had never gotten in the mail for. The fines had doubled and I owed, it must have been like $800, Austin, in order to get the boot off. Now, shame on me, I guess, for not checking the website every couple of months just routinely to make sure I didn't have any outstanding fines. And by the way, I looked at the video, all those, and it was simply because I had not come to a full stop before I made a right turn. And they pinged me for that, which again, I shouldn't be rolling through red light intersections on a right turn. I get that. But these fines double, and that's where they're going to be collecting so much money. And that really, really hurts poorer communities, the unpaid fines doubling over time.
Yes, totally. And it's obviously much more likely to happen to a lower income resident.
Right.
Who can't, at that very moment, come up with $35 to pay toward this fine. And I believe that goes up to $85. And then the $100 tickets, I think, go up to more like $220, something in that range. Sounds like that's what happened to you.
Oh, yeah.
And for the red light cameras specifically, the reason those are in Chicago is because of a guy who's in jail for corruption. His name was John Bills. He was an official at the Chicago Department of Transportation and was convicted of taking bribes to put in red light cameras in the city of Chicago. And yet they're still up. And so this is the final point on, how insidious these things are is the city's just proven with red light cameras and speed cameras that they can't responsibly operate these kinds of tools. If you remember with red light cameras, remember they lowered the yellow light time to generate more revenue.
Yeah, 2.9 below to what the instead of the 3.0, yeah.
These little games that are clearly driven by revenue and not by safety. And I think it's the same thing for the 6-mile-an-hour limit on the speed cameras. So that's why, people think it's sort of extreme. You don't want to be like, a revolutionary and just start tearing these things down. But I think that's actually the only solution in the long term that's most workable and has the most benefit for the most people in the city of Chicago is just take these down. City leaders have proven year after year after year they cannot use them responsibly.
Yeah, I'm torn. I mean, we obviously have a situation and maybe we're not addressing the core, and I imagine that would be your argument, we're not addressing the core problems in terms of spending. But there, without a doubt, there's a gap and you've got to try and find some ways to get more revenue or cut spending. And maybe it's a combo of both those things that gets us there a little bit quicker. So I guess I understand the desire to have them up, but then just say that. I don't know why, don't make it in the sense of it's because you're kind of near a park, which there's been so many write-ups about these cameras aren't actually all that close to parks or schools. Just level with us.
Right. And that's what, if you remember the soda tax, it was all like health, health, health. And then I think Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle was like, oh, yeah, it's actually about the money. Yeah. People are like, thank you. Exactly. Just say it out loud. And the thing, here's the other dirty little secret about these. The speed cameras, I said, $73 million last year. That's a lot of money to you and I, but to the city budget, if you recall, like during the CPS-CTU battle, CPS alone got $1 billion from the federal government. And you could easily replace this revenue if you really don't want to cut spending at all on anything, which Chicago needs to do. But say you take that as a given that nothing else is going to get cut. Even just with the federal money that came in over the last year, you could cover a decade's worth of these sorts of tickets and find another solution in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like it's a big chunk of change, but it's also, I mean, it is a huge amount of money, but it's not solving the big problems anyway. So it's like, is it worth the, you know, the long-term
strife? Is the juice worth the squeeze?
Right.
Yeah,
hey,
like you're hitting two tickets per household.
Right.
I couldn't think of a way, like it's almost specifically designed to take money in the most annoying way for the most people in the city of Chicago.
Right.
Like you can't even imagine another policy that would generate this much anger and this little revenue.
Austin Berg, hey, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
All right, we'll have Ray Kaplan talking about college loans and a lawsuit against five colleges, including one here in Illinois. We'll do that after the news here on 720 WGN. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Hey, everyone, John Hansen here, and we're just minutes away from Blackhawks hockey. We've got it for you at the top of the hour, as always. Okay, a lot of stories recently about student loans. When is student loans not in the news? But really recently, we've had some important stories, and here to break those down, Ray Kaplan. You know her, you love her, and you do such great work at financialrelief.com. Ray, thanks for hopping on with us here today.
Absolutely. Anytime. Happy to be here with you.
Do you get that a lot when people hear or see any story about college loans? Their brain just goes, Ray Kaplan.
Yes, I do. I get a ton of text messages and emails, and I'm happy about it. That's okay, because it's been a long time working to be the kind of student loan expert. So I'm happy about that.
Let's say czar. I don't know. I like that title for you, right? I don't know. We'll workshop that off after the air, after we get off the air. Let's talk about a big settlement that was announced on Thursday with Navient. Walk us through this one.
Right. So there were about 39 state's attorneys general suing Navient, which is one of the nation's biggest student loan servicers. And basically, the lawsuit claimed that Navient engaged in unfair and deceptive practices by steering borrowers into forbearances. And then what happens is that their loan balances really started to grow, and that they didn't advise them appropriately about different income-based repayment plans or different options that they had available to them. And this is something I tell my clients all the time. You can't rely on what the servicers tell you, because I've been on conference calls with my clients and the servicer where the servicer will say some crazy things that are just not accurate. So this lawsuit really, I think, was to address this issue. And they recently reached a huge settlement. Now, Navient did not admit any guilt or any wrongdoing.
Shocker.
But it's a $1.7 billion in private student loan cancellation for borrowers who attended for-profit institutions like ITT Tech and certain art institutes. They'll also pay $95 million in restitution payments to about 350,000 federal student loan borrowers who are placed in certain types of long-term forbearances. That's only going to amount to about $260 per borrower. And then they're also going to be required to improve communications with borrowers about public sector loan forgiveness, and all that kind of stuff. But it also is going to mean that about 66,000 borrowers who had private student loans with Navient, I believe that were originated between 2002 and 2010, the ones which started out as Sallie Mae and then were transferred to Navient, some of those loans, if they were in default, will be forgiven. So if you are one of those people who had private student loans that started out with Sallie Mae that were transferred to Navient and that were in default, this might apply to you, and those loans might be forgiven.
Do you have to do the legwork yourself? Are they going to reach out to you and let you know? Or are you going to have to go to a website or something to see if your name is on those lists?
That remains to be seen. I think that all of that is going to come out pretty soon. Navient, there's another kind of subsidiary of Navient called AidVantage. So AidVantage, if your loans are being serviced by Navient, it might be switched to AidVantage, which is a subsidiary of Navient.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And so
it's just like mortgages, right? They get sold so many times. I couldn't tell you I don't know. I'm sure it's somewhere on a sheet of paper somewhere, which bank now I pay the check to, because it's all done automatically. And really, if you have a private student loan, it would be worth it to at least just check if anywhere in that chain of custody of that loan, Navient's in part of it.
Absolutely. And so if you had loans that were Sallie Mae and that were transferred to Navient and you think they were dispersed between 2002 and 2010, you know, you can also call up Navient and ask them for a copy of the contract. A lot of people don't know, you know, they don't remember, but you can call them and get a copy of the contract, take a look at what you signed on for, when the loans were dispersed, et cetera, and then ask them if you're a part of this settlement. So they have a duty they have to tell you.
All right. Well, that is good news. Do you feel like this, I mean, is this the biggest settlement of this sort of scale that we've seen? Are there more down the horizon? Does this embolden people to sue?
I think so. This is a big one. And this was really brought, it had a lot of teeth because it was brought by different states joining. I remember reading about it back in 2017, and it was California and a few other states, maybe about four states. And then Lisa Madigan joined, and then, you know, it was 39 states joined in this lawsuit. So we knew that something big was going to come of it. So yeah, this is big news though.
All right. Well, that's good. That's one story down. Let's talk about one that came out a little bit earlier in the week, but it does impact Northwestern University, part of a, quote, cartel of elite universities. Not my words. It was the words in the lawsuit. What's going on with people suing in terms of admissions?
So this is a really interesting case, because when I counsel my clients on, we do a lot of pre-debt planning, you know, how to plan for if your child or children are going to college, what it's going to cost, and how to plan for this if you don't have all the money saved. And a lot of these colleges are between $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 per year. So basically, what we would tell people, because they would say, well, how do we know if they're going to qualify for financial aid? And we would have to tell them, we really don't know, because the formula that the schools are applying to, the information that you put in your FAFSA application and how they apply a formula, it's all proprietary. They don't have to tell us, well, this is how we come up with it, whether or not your kid is going to get, you know, financial aid. So we would basically just assume that they would need most of the tuition in terms of federal student loans and then calculate on that basis. Well, this lawsuit is interesting because we might be able to find out that information that was previously a mystery through discovery. It might come out, because college graduates are suing 16 major universities for essentially colluding to limit the financial aid to undergrad students in violation of antitrust laws. So the plaintiffs are seeking to be approved as a class, so that they can bring a class action. They're saying that this collusion has limited price competition and caused about 170,000 financial aid recipients to be overcharged by hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 20 years. And, you know, there is a lot of mystery in terms of, on what basis are you approving financial aid or not allowing financial aid? And it makes the process kind of tricky for students going into college. And so now what they're saying in this lawsuit is that these 16 colleges have all been kind of colluding, which is really terrible, because a lot of these colleges, they have billions of dollars, you know, in their,
in their endowments.
Funds.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. So wait, I just want to make sure I understand. So they think they're saying that the formulas used or the processes in which they dole out financial aid, that one college is talking to another one so that they all have similar metrics, so that that isn't a competitive advantage for any of them, just like any other monopoly that we've heard of throughout history.
Correct. That's what they're alleging. And if they get this certified as a class action, and it survives a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment, then through discovery, we might be really finding out more about how these colleges have been making these determinations over the last, you know, 20 years about who's going to get financial aid and who is not, and whether or not they really were colluding to limit financial aid to undergrads, you know, who were in the most need of it.
So for someone listening that says, oh, I thought financial aid is just done based on income, maybe a few other factors, we really don't know exactly the formulas that certain colleges use to how they disperse this?
Right. It's proprietary. We have no right to actually get our hands on it.
All right. Especially, and I imagine, because these are private universities that are named in this suit, right?
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense to me. All right. Ray Kaplan, you're so good at breaking this stuff down. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then I want to talk through some more. Student loan forgiveness. Every time I log onto Twitter, there's someone else screaming at someone that their student loan should be forgiven, right? I want to find out if any of that is really possible, what has happened so far, and what could be coming next. That's up next here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. 720 WGN, John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Blackhawks coming on your way next here on WGN. We've been talking about student loans and a couple lawsuits somewhat related to that earlier with Ray Kaplan, but this is your bread and butter here, Ray Kaplan, financialrelief.com, where people can go, 312-294-8989. I cannot advise people who have any questions about student loans or where to go, what to turn to, then calling that number and going to that website. I really mean that, Ray. You're so good at breaking this all down for people. You really are the czar of all student loans. Okay, everywhere I turn, it's people arguing about whether President Biden can, should, will forgive student loans. And then someone has a story saying, oh, no, he's already done a bunch. And some people are saying, but not mine. Where are we in this world of loan relief? I know that's a real broad question, but just curious.
Sure. So there has been a lot going on in terms of the world of federal student loans. So the big problem really was that there's this statute. So there's a law that governs all things federal student loans. And part of it was to give people who were working in the public sector. So in Chicago, you know, most of the big hospital systems, Advocate, Amida, Northwestern, University of Chicago, police officers, public school teachers, all those guys, if they had federal student loans, they were supposed to get forgiveness of their loans after 10 years of payments. But the problem is that the servicers were kind of screwing up and not giving people accurate advice about how to qualify for that kind of loan forgiveness. So a lot of people who maybe should have been getting student loan forgiveness were not getting it. So what the Biden administration did was they said, okay, look, what we're going to do is for the next year, and this applies through October 31st of 2022, if you get your employment certification forms in and consolidate federally your student loans, then we will go back and give you credit for payments that previously you were turned down for, that basically where they told you, oh, these loans don't qualify or these payments don't qualify, so you don't get public sector loan forgiveness.
So they'll go back in time and fix it.
Yes, exactly. So there, we just had a client who had $170,000 of her loans forgiven under this PSLF waiver. There's a process to do it properly so that you get your loans forgiven, and it's a limited time opportunity. And I think that it's going to result in over maybe $2 billion of loans being forgiven. So it's going to be a lot of loan forgiveness. It's not that, you know, broad sweeping $10,000 off of everybody's loans, but it's really life-changing for a lot of people. We have one client with $170,000 forgiven, another client with $72,000 forgiven. So, I mean, or if you were, let's say, you know, the magic number is 120 months, well, now they'll go back and give you credit. So you might be at 110 months, whereas, you know, if this hadn't happened, you would be starting from zero. So you are that much closer to getting your loans forgiven. So it's very important for anybody who's working in the public sector or worked in the public sector. And we can, of course, help you unravel it. If you want to give us a call, we can help you go through it, because it is kind of a confusing process.
Do they give you a check? Like, how does that work?
So they will give you forgiveness of the balance. And if you have overpaid, because we have a lot of clients who are getting big refunds as right. well. So they'll refund the money into your account. Also, if you've been making payments during this COVID CARES Act forbearance and not realizing that the loans are supposed to be in forbearance, then all that money is supposed to be refunded to you and you still get loan forgiveness. So there's a lot of forgiveness out there. I think that they're not doing a great job publicizing it or making enough people aware of it. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. If people's ears perked up either at that $170,000 example or the big number that you listed off, remind people again, who are you looking to maybe reach out to you? If there's a few quick facts that'll help those people that are interested go, oh, wait, that is me or that is someone I know.
Okay. If you have federal student loans and if you worked in the public sector, basically any time from October 2007 forward, and if you were employed in the public sector for 120 months. So that's a really good starting point, because then we can go back and do an audit and see how many of those payments we can get to count under this PSLF waiver. The other thing to remember is that we have to apply before October 31st, 2022. If we apply November 1st, 2022, we're out of luck. So it's only up to October 31st. So it's very important not to miss it.
That's like the worst Halloween ever if you miss out on that. okay. So, and public sector, I think a lot of people has an idea what that means, but sometimes it's broader than people think.
Yes. I mean, if you work in a cafeteria at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, you qualify for public sector loan forgiveness. If you're a nurse at one of those hospital systems I mentioned before, or a public school teacher, or a janitor at a public school, or a nurse, or a fireman, or a police officer, all those are considered public sector employment.
Okay, I've got that down. So, Ray, if they want to reach out to you, financialrelief.com is the best place to get started?
Yes, or give us a call at 312-294-8989.
Yeah, that is great. I'm going to read it one more time for people, because I know people are scrambling for their pens and pencils. 312-294-8989, and that's Kaplan, Ray Kaplan. I just love your slogan, there's light ahead, because you really are giving people sometimes their life back in a way, right?
Yeah, I love what I do, because it's so nice to see the relief that comes over people, because that is kind of life-changing. If you previously had $1,000 a month loan payment and we can just get rid of it for you, it really is. It's so nice.
That's great. Ray, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
And that'll do it for Let's Get Legal here on 720 WGN. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Really appreciate that. Of course, we got Blackhawks hockey coming up next. And next Saturday, looking ahead, obviously tonight we were on at a different time, 5 to 7, because of Northwestern earlier. Next week there is a Blackhawks game, but it's later. I believe it's on the West Coast next Saturday. So an evening game at around 8 o'clock. And we're going to be on at our normal time, 3 to 5 p.m. So you can find us there for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association.